You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ever wonder what Wausau's climate will look like in six decades? Well, a growing body of climate change research is giving us a clearer answer. We'll get the details from a UW-Madison researcher. First, changes in our politics, economy, and media over time have left things feeling divided for a lot of people. Whether it's online or in person, civil conversations about big issues of the day can be tough to come by. A new exhibit at Appleton's History Museum is using charts and graphs to track some of those changes during the last 50 years and hopefully get people talking to each other. It's called Bridging the Gap Years, 1969 through 2019. It's on display through the end of the month. Dustin Mack is chief curator of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. Dustin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, walk us in the door of the exhibit, Dustin. What are we going to see?
Sure. So the idea of the exhibit is that if you've been following the news cycle from day to day, it can feel very overwhelming. And what this exhibit tries to do is to put our current problems and our current divisions in historic context. So we framed it 1969 to 2019 in order to give people kind of a sense of where we've been. So if you've studied 1969 or for your listeners who have lived through that year, it was a tumultuous time as well. And knowing that we came out on the other end and that we survived that time is comforting in the present, but it also clarifies the challenges. So we've identified four main gaps to look at in this exhibit. So political polarization, income inequality, the decline of empathy, and then there's been an increase in feelings of social isolation. And so each of these four kind of major gaps are treated on separate pop-up banners that present data with that information.
When people hear the word museum, they might think stuff from a long time ago, or they might think art, past and present. What led you to want to tackle this thing with this huge contemporary significance?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when history is done well, we study the past in order to understand the present. So in order to understand the world that we live in, who we are as a people and as a community, it really takes studying the past and knowing how we got from point B to point A. And that really helps us kind of clarify the current moment. And that's what this exhibit tries to do.
What are some of the visuals we'll see to try to put that into perspective?
Sure. So the information that's presented is all from very reputable sources that was important to our research. And so there are bright visuals, kind of infographic styles on the banners that gives you kind of a snapshot of the here and now, where we've been and where we are currently. So it's a lot of data that tracks like religion in the United States. It tracks depression, it tracks incomes from the 1960s up into the present. And this is just as a way to try to start the conversation and gives people a way that they can kind of focus on certain areas and begin talking about those.
And speaking of starting conversations, that's one of the big goals here, right?
Absolutely. So we don't want to weigh you down and depress anybody with this information because these are four really heavy topics. So the idea is that you go through the exhibit, and then in the center of the space is we're calling it a gathering area. And so here people are supposed to come together and reflect on what it is that they saw and have conversations about how we got to this point in history and what it means. And in order to do this, we adopted, they're called Living Room Conversations. And so this is a national nonprofit organization that creates kind of easy how-to guides to have these tough conversations. And so we want people to come through the exhibit, think about this data, but then come together in the center of the room and have these tough conversations and figure out a way for collaborative problem solving.
So what's happened when you bring people together? Is this like just strangers who happen to be seeing the exhibit at the same time, sitting down and talking?
So that has happened. We've got a lot of people who have come through. They come to the museum as a group of people and they go through. We've had some classes that come through and then they sit and they have these conversations. Just yesterday, actually, we had a living room conversation with representatives Mike Gallagher and Mark Pocan, who came together and rather than talking about the political divisions that can separate us at times, they talked about our shared American values and the things that we all have in common. And this building this common ground is really the place to start. And then we can start, trying to solve problems from there.
Talking to Dustin Mack, Chief Curator of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. We're looking at a current exhibit there. It runs through the end of the month. It's called Bridging the Gap Years. It traces changes in American society, divisions, in some cases growing divisions in various ways over the last 50 years. Dustin, you just mentioned the two state lawmakers from different parties talking about shared values. I think there's a sense that nowadays, maybe especially with social media and different partisan media outlets, we're better at highlighting or better at finding those ways where we can argue than we are at finding those ways where we can find common ground.
Oh, absolutely. The rise of social media has created a lot of divisions in American society. So the promise of social media was that we'd all be interconnected and have this wide-ranging share of ideas, which in some regards is true, but it's also allowed us to segregate ourselves into, our discrete camps. And so, if you're a Republican, you follow Republicans and you are, in that news cycle. And if you're a Democrat, you're doing the same on the other side. And so what this exhibit is trying to do is get people to come together and have face-to-face conversations. So I like to use the example of if you're at, a family gathering or dinner with friends, and you can disagree and have all kinds of arguments, but at the end of the day, you don't demonize or hate the other person because you know who they are. You know that they're coming from a good place. You might just disagree with kind of the outcome of it. So the more we can get people coming together and having these shared experiences and understanding where the other person is coming from, I think then we can kind of deviate away from that social media aspect where we're just name-calling.
You mentioned that conversation at the exhibit with Democrat Mark Pocan and Republican Mike Gallagher from our congressional delegation. What were some of the shared values that they pointed to as ways to start coming from a common place instead of from those points of disagreement?
The sense of service that they both have is what really stuck out to me. So the reason they both got into politics is that they saw a problem and they wanted to solve it. So they felt this calling to do something about it. I think one of them said, put your money where your mouth is. So this sense of duty and that they wanted to kind of ensure that the next generations had the same rights and privileges that the rest of Americans have had, and as a way to preserve that and try to make things better in the future. And they really share that in common, despite having different political views.
You mentioned one of the groups you were collaborating with. I also understand Story Catchers, and I think also StoryCorps, who public radio listeners might be familiar with, have been involved at some stage of the game. What kind of partnerships do you have?
Yes, we have some excellent partnerships to make this exhibit possible. So Story Catchers, which is a local organization based out of the Fox Cities, and they do community storytelling. So they've agreed to be in residence throughout this exhibit, and they will touch on the different topics that are brought up in the exhibit, and they allow the community to tell their stories. So individuals get up in front of a group of people and they kind of share their experiences with social isolation or income inequality. And it puts a real human face on the data that's being presented in this exhibit. We also partnered with StoryCorps. So as your listeners will know, they're another national organization that helps people tell their stories. So last year, the History Museum at the Castle won a national medal for museum and library service. And as part of winning that award, StoryCorps paid us a visit. And so we had community members come in and document their history and tell their stories that will be preserved for generations to come.
Talk a little bit about the value of the historical perspective and looking at our issues today, because a lot of times, and I've talked to historians about this, we feel like now, okay, this is current events, this is real life, history is something that's safely tucked away and distant. What can we learn when we try to bring those two closer together?
Yeah, to me, history opens up a whole new world, and it can be very comforting in ways. So there's almost no problem that we face today or situation that we would face today that people before us haven't confronted in some shape or fashion. Now, the details are always changing in history, and that's why we can't use history to kind of predict the future. But we can use it to gain perspective and try to understand where we are. So as far as like income inequality, that's presented in the in the exhibit, and you can track through time kind of the jumps in the divisions that have happened between the income brackets. And in some ways, that's comforting to know that there were those divisions there before, but it's also kind of a challenge that we can see this growing division happening in real time.
You've got this exhibit through the end of the month. Do you want to carry the project or the intent of the project forward even after that?
Oh, absolutely. We know that the information and the gaps that we're trying to address are major issues, and they go well beyond anything that one exhibit can do. And so we've designed this exhibit to travel. So after it closes at the History Museum on March 31st, it will be available for free to travel the Fox cities and across the state if people want. That you can bring these banners, you can bring these living room conversations to your school or your church, your organization, what have you, and begin to talk about these issues and put the programming that they want to have with it. So if it's a dance class or it's a political discussion, anything that brings people together that can put a human face on things and get people reconnecting. We really want this exhibit to live on well beyond its life here at the museum.
Well, Dustin, if somebody's out there thinking, yeah, this would be perfect for my school, library, group, whatever, how can they hook up with this?
Sure. So they can just contact me directly. My email is dustin@myhistorymuseum.org, or they can go to the History Museum's website, which is myhistorymuseum.org, and find more information there.
In our last minute or so, Dustin, talk about the response you've gotten from people who have come through the exhibit, maybe had or witnessed these conversations.
It's been overwhelmingly positive. So I have gotten so many people that have said, thank you for trying to address these issues. I think there's a general sense, at least here in the Fox Cities, that it's time to start dealing with some of these problems. And everybody sees them, but they don't know really how to go about beginning. And so these conversations are just a way to kind of start that process, and hopefully it leads to something larger.
Dustin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's Dustin Mack, Chief Curator of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. He joined us to talk about the ongoing exhibit there. It's called Bridging the Gap Years. It traces changes in American society over the last 50 years, things like partisan division, income inequality, social isolation, and more. The exhibit runs through the end of the month, and as you heard, it might, if you want it to, appear in a place near you. Coming up, we'll talk about new climate change research that helps people see what future climates will be like where they live, even an interactive online map that lets you click and see what the weather today in another state might mean for your weather in the future. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, lawmakers in Congress are weighing their options following the president's veto of a bill that would block his national emergency declaration. We'll find out what they're looking at in our weekly roundup of national politics. First, when we talk about climate change, it's often on a global scale, things like worldwide rises in temperatures and international treaties. But what about the impact on your community's climate? That's a question researchers published last month in the journal Nature Communications. Researchers created an interactive map where you can click on a place in the United States and find out what the weather might be in 60 years by comparing it with the current weather elsewhere in the country. For example, Milwaukee's weather in 2080 might look like parts of West Virginia today. Jack Williams is a paleoclimatologist and professor in UW-Madison's Department of Geography. He's worked on a similar project using climate analogs for the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into these models, a lot of times when we hear about global warming or climate change, we hear about global scale things or what's going on in the Arctic, things like that. Does that make it hard for people to think about this as an issue that might be close to home?
I think so. Often people think of climate as something that's happening somewhere else to other people. And so, yes, that is one of the challenges with climate change communications.
And let's look at these modeling systems. There's this new one out in the journals now, similar to something you've done in the past. What are they trying to do? What were you doing with yours and in this new effort now?
So what we did and what this new effort is doing is what's called climate analog mapping, in which we say, okay, here's what the models project will be the climates of the future, say 50 years out or 80 years out. And what are the most similar climates today somewhere else in the U.S.? So, for example, we say, you know, Wisconsin, Madison would be 3 degrees, 5 degrees warmer. What places around elsewhere in the U.S. have those kinds of temperatures? Where are they? Where are they located?
And it's not, as I understand it, just temperatures necessarily. There are other parameters. So what all kinds of things do you dig into?
That's right. So we're looking at temperature and rainfall and precipitation for winter months, summer months, different times of the year. So these are what we call multivariate climate analog analysis. We look at many variables all at once.
And this is based on our current rate of the world's current rate of CO2 emissions, right? This is kind of in a stay the course, this is what we got and we're sticking with it scenario.
That's right. So climate scientists use what are called scenarios, which we work with, you know, higher end scenarios, a stay the course kind of scenario, or these more mitigation scenarios. The new paper that's just out is a high end stay the course. We don't make any mitigation efforts.
And as I understand it, your effort was, 8 years ago or so? Is that right? 7, 8 years
ago? About 8 years ago. That's right.
And there's this new one, and you found pretty good agreement between the two.
Yeah, that's right. One of the nice things is that we were using a previous generation of models from the fourth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They're using the latest generation from the fifth assessment. And our maps and their maps in terms of where these climate analogs are coming from are pretty similar to each other.
So give us more senses of where someone in Wisconsin and various communities might look around the country to say, okay, your weather today might be our weather tomorrow or in 50 years.
Well, I definitely encourage people to go to the website itself because they have a really nice interactive mapping tool that they created.
You can click on your hometown more or
less. That's what's really fun. You can click on your hometown, with the maps we made, which are up on the wiki page. You can click on any location in Wisconsin and you can click and then see where your analog is coming from. But for a place like Madison, then places like East Kansas or sometimes Eastern Oklahoma come up as the best analogs. Again, consistent with warmer climates and often somewhat around here, some models say wetter, some models say drier. So there's a bit more variability there.
I know one concern with climate change isn't just the average temperature or the average rainfall. It's the likelihood of extreme events. These models that we can go to and that'll visualize this, they don't get into that. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And you can really see that around here in the sense of we're having big flooding in the Midwest. We had big flooding in Madison at the start of the school year. So it's these extreme events that really cause the most damage and they're in some ways the most important aspects of climate change. The models do simulate those. But in terms of these aggregated climate analog analyses, those are just focusing on mean climates, mean monthly temperatures, mean seasonal conditions.
But that is one of the things we worry about, right, is that if we raise the chance of a drought a little bit, that over time, the chance of drought will go up. The chance of getting 2 years of drought in a row goes up. Same with flooding, whatever extreme weather event we're worried about.
That's right. And the models are very consistent projecting that this part of the upper Midwest and much of the U.S. in general is likely to have more extreme rain events, more big rain events, and a lot of rain in a short amount of time, and then also longer periods of dry or drought between those rain events as well.
Talking to Jack Williams with the Department of Geography at UW-Madison, looking at models of climate change, not global, but ones where you could go online. We'll post these online, by the way. Click on your community and see what the weather of the future might look like. Where else in the country's weather today might look like your weather tomorrow, your climate tomorrow. What are you hoping that people do with models like these? How could they use them?
Well, one of the real goals of these kinds of models and these maps is to make climate change accessible for people, right? You hear, well, 3 degrees warming in the future, 5 degrees warming. How big a deal is that? These, I think, analyses really help communicate to people that these kinds of climate changes are really important. If you imagine driving from Madison down to eastern Kansas and thinking about the different kinds of landscapes, the different kinds of plants, the different kinds of animals, the different kinds of crops grown in those areas, they're really different. So a few degrees of global temperature change or regional temperature change can have major impacts upon an area.
Now, I've already heard, I think, from the gardening community that the time to plant is slowly changing. We're looking like that band, a couple steps to the south used to look. Is that the sort of thing we might do and say, whether we're home gardeners or farmers, this might give me information about when I plant what and where?
That's right. The USDA has its plant hardiness zones, and they have to update those now every couple decades because those plant hardiness zones are shifting northwards as winter temperatures rise. And right, if you are a gardener or if you're a farmer, you could use these climate analog maps as a pretty good first pass representation of what your climates might look like in the not too distant future and how to best prepare and plan.
Now, I've talked to entomologists who are worried that some kind of ticks, for example, might be making their way northward, better able to survive in our Wisconsin environment. Is that another community that might be able to use this kind of data to say, okay, if we look like eastern Kansas in 50 years, what unpleasant things could survive here that can't right now.
That's right. You worry about agricultural pests. You worry about various ticks and other insects that carry disease. You think about urban pests like termites. Many of these different insect species are temperature limited in their northern range. We're fortunate in southern Wisconsin not to have many of them. We could expect more of them to be moving into the state as temperatures rise.
Are there efforts to do this with other scenarios, maybe more optimistic scenarios, something happens to change things for the better, or more pessimistic scenarios, because sometimes we see the models underestimate the speed of climate change?
That's right. There's a lot of interest these days in what's called the 1.5 scenario, which is how can we keep the global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius? Right now, we've had about 1 degree Celsius warming so far. And there's already lots of things we're seeing, more intensified storms. We're seeing coral die-offs. We're seeing flood events in the upper Midwest. So there's a lot of interest now in how do we stabilize the climate system and keep total warming globally below 1.5, and more scenarios being developed around that.
Are you hoping that policymakers will take a look at these new maps, the maps you did a few years back, and use that in their decision-making?
I certainly hope so. You know, these maps are really intended to be used by anyone who wants to use them, whether they're legislatures or citizens or farmers or other scientists. Again, the point of these sort of climate analog maps is to make them very readily accessible. So you could look in your home district, for example, if you're a legislator, and see the kinds of climates that you and your constituents might expect to experience.
In addition to these kinds of maps, these great visualizations, what other efforts are out there to try to figure out the impact of climate change in our backyards, again, as opposed to globally?
Oh, there's all kinds of efforts. You know, working at UW-Madison, of course, one of the great research universities of the world, there's all kinds of things happening there. People are working on ways of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions or sequestering carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Lots of us are working on different kinds of ecological impacts and how to help plant species and bird species adapt. There's efforts with UW Extension to communicate those efforts. There are carbon dioxide monitoring towers in the North Woods and on Lake Mendota. There's just all kinds of things happening all over the place.
We'll leave it there for now. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a great conversation.
That was Jack Williams, paleoclimatologist and professor in UW-Madison's Department of Geography. He was with us to talk about a research tool that's helping people understand how climate change will impact their communities. You can read more and check out the interactive maps at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, President Trump issued his first veto to protect his emergency declaration on border wall funding. We'll find out how Congress might respond in our weekly roundup of national news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a bipartisan state task force started its work today to study water quality issues across Wisconsin. We'll talk to the chair of the committee about what was discussed and what might come out of this process. First, we take a look at some of the week's top news in national politics. More candidates are joining the 2020 presidential field. President Trump has condemned last week's deadly mass shooting targeting mosques in New Zealand, but says white nationalism isn't a growing problem. And lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are figuring out what to do after the president vetoed a motion to block his national emergency declaration. You can join in on that at 800-642-1234. Do you think Congress should pass a bill that would limit the president's ability to declare a national emergency in the future? Do you think the executive branch is too powerful? When do you think a national emergency should be able to be declared? Should Congress override the president's veto? Should Congress override the president's veto? Got mixed up there. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This stuff gets complicated. Sarah Ferris is a congressional reporter for Politico. She joins us now from the U.S. Capitol building. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, you can straighten me out here. President Trump vetoed that resolution passed by Congress that would have blocked his national emergency declaration. Is that the end of the story now, or what happens next?
So it basically is the end of the story, but there will be at least one more symbolic vote that we'll see in a couple of days. We'll see exactly how many House Republicans are willing to take this final stand against President Trump. There were about a dozen or so Republicans who initially said that they would back Democrats over the president on this. And that's pretty notable, of course. But to actually be able to sustain this veto, it would require more than 50 House Republicans, which there is virtually no chance of. So basically, this is just a chance for Democrats to have one more time to get all the Republicans on the record. And then they'll use every one of these votes for 2020 ads. But it is something that Democrats are going to be focusing on this week when they come back for recess.
And even if they somehow pass that in the House, the Senate would have to do the same thing. They'd have to get that two-thirds majority. They didn't have that on the original vote, right?
That's right. They only had 12 Republicans breaking ranks and supporting Democrats on this, and including members who actually switched their vote. Senator Tom Tillis, who's up for re-election next year in North Carolina, took a lot of heads. Made a lot of headlines last week when he actually reversed his position that he'd laid out in a Washington Post op-ed. And then there was the threat that he would actually see a Republican primary challenger because he was willing to buck the president. And within a couple of days, guess what? He sided with Trump at the end of the day.
Are we at this magical time of year already, even though elections aren't until next year, where everybody's looking over their shoulder for 2020 elections?
Well, this is a rare chance for a House legislation to actually get a vote in the Senate. It's not every day that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is going to put his members on these contentious, issues. The only reason that this actually made it to the Senate is because it was a privileged resolution. So the House voted on it and it triggered a vote within the Senate within 18 days. So that will not be the case for the vast majority of bills. For example, any of the House background check bills, any of the gun control bills that Democrats have passed, Mitch McConnell can make the decision not to bring those up for a vote. So there will be some fodder about primary challenges and 2020 and all these sorts of dramatic things, but it'll be pretty short-lived because the rest of this is going to be the majority leader striking down any attempts by Nancy Pelosi to get some legislation through the Senate.
So Congress probably won't override the veto on this particular emergency declaration, but there's also talk of laws regarding future emergency declarations by this president and whoever might follow him. What's going on with that?
That's right. So basically, there are a lot of Republicans who are uncomfortable about what the president is doing. And these are Republicans who may even have sided with the president on this. Again, they're very conscious of where their votes will end up being broadcast ahead of their next election. But behind the scenes, they've been talking with each other. They've been trying to figure out ways that they can go on record in another way of trying to rein in presidential power. This was, of course, a huge issue when President Obama was in the White House. There were Republicans constantly complaining that he was overreaching and putting out executive orders on immigration and all that sorts of things. And now they have a president of their own party in the White House, and they're actually trying to change the legislation in the future so that a Democratic president, whenever there is next one in the White House, can't do the same thing on climate change or gun control or any other sorts of progressive priorities that Democrats are even now saying that they could see happen in the future.
And Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, as I understand, is spearheading this effort to look at these emergency powers. Do we have an idea of whether this is going to be something that happens quickly, or is this something that might be a months-long process?
This is something that I don't think will get a lot of daylight. At least it won't make it through the Senate. Democratic leaders in the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, have made clear that they're not interested in doing this. They would rather have Republicans be on the record opposing this current national declaration. They're not going to allow Republicans to change the rules for the future when their own president is in power, and they've already allowed that president to do what he wants on this issue. They're going to try and box in Republicans and not give them another way out and say, if you really want to stop the abuse of presidential power that you see happening, you have to condemn this president. You can't wait and scapegoat the next president.
Talking to Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico. We're looking at some of the top news of the week in national politics. Sarah, I want to turn to a piece you wrote, Democrats in charge of the House now, but they're having some trouble keeping all their caucus in line here, especially when it comes to this thing, and this gets a bit obscure. I'm hoping you can explain it to us, a motion to recommit. Tell us what that is and how it's being used.
Well, I promise not to get too wonky, but basically there is one opportunity that the minority party has in the House to influence legislation before it's passed. And it is this one maneuver that Republicans have successfully weaponized against Democrats. And now this Republicans are, of course, they are new to the minority, but they've taken tactics that their extreme Freedom Caucus has perfected over the years, and they're trying to be as much of a pain in Democrats' side. They're causing all sorts of procedural votes, and they're trying to use language that vulnerable Democrats are very weary of. So, for example, during the shutdown, they had all sorts of language added that would have things to do with child care workers accused of sexual abuse, and they put language in the bills and tried to force freshman members to go home and explain why they would vote against taking action on a child care worker accused of child abuse, and all these sorts of really difficult things to try and explain, when in actuality the legislation would not have gone anywhere because the Republicans who tried to add the language voted against the underlying bill. So these are just gotcha votes. They're just gambits to try and embarrass Democrats. And what's been really interesting is the last couple of weeks is Republicans have started to win. They've actually won two of these votes, which is pretty unheard of. And Democrats basically scrambled within their party to try and figure out what to do. And they have, of course, dozens of vulnerable Democrats who feel endangered. They don't want to see these be the subject of attack ads in their next election, with Republicans quickly trying to utilize the records on these votes. So there's been a scrambling within a party and trying to convince Democrats to stick together, even if it means several of the members being pretty vulnerable for attack ads from Republicans.
I don't, maybe it was under the radar, I don't remember Democrats doing this as the minority party or doing it successfully, or did I just miss something?
Well, they did. This did used to be an issue when Democrats were in power. It was definitely not as much on the radar. I think part of that is because social media and these very fast response campaign style tactics, these are much more prevalent now than they were in the early 2000s and into the mid 2000s. So I think Democrats were certainly not skilled at doing this. They weren't using the same kinds of gotcha tactics to try and make life difficult for Republicans. A lot of times they were actually trying to substantively influence the legislation, trying to get actual policy priorities into the legislation versus what Republicans are doing, which is, you know, for example, when there were controversial remarks that were considered anti-Semitic by one of the Democrats, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, Republicans put in language on anti-Semitism. And so they were trying to force, and they added this language into a bill, and it ended up stripping the bill of these special privileges in the Senate and are forcing a do-over of the vote in the House. So that was one of the ones that Republicans did successfully win. So that was one of the biggest impacts, and that really caused what triggered this issue to the top levels of the Democratic leadership.
We're talking to Sarah Ferris, reporter for Politico, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, more candidates officially joining the 2020 presidential race on the Democratic side. More expected to follow, maybe pretty soon. What are you looking for in a candidate? Who do you hope runs? If you're a Democrat in your party, if you're a Republican, who do you hope to run against this time around? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Sarah Ferris of Politico, looking at some of the week's news out of Washington. You can join in with your thoughts on the 2020 growing presidential field. More and more Democrats entering the race. We'll be talking about that in just a minute. 800-642-1234. What are you looking for in a candidate to run for or to run against? Call 800-642-1234. And what issue is most important to you as you consider the options? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah, before we get to this, President Trump had condemned last week's mass shooting in New Zealand that left 50 people dead. He also told reporters in the Oval Office on Friday he doesn't see white nationalism as a growing threat around the world. Here's a listen.
I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems. I guess if you look at what happened in New Zealand, perhaps that's a case. I don't know enough about it yet.
What have we been hearing from members of Congress about the incident itself and the president's response?
I think members of Congress, particularly Democrats, are, of course, stunned by this event. They want to use this as a chance to highlight the growing threat that they see white nationalism posing, not only in New Zealand, not only in the U.S., but across the globe, really. So there are some Democrats who have tried to link the language from President Trump specifically to these events. I think that's something that not all Democrats are willing to go towards. Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut was one who did seem to suggest that Trump's rhetoric had perhaps led to a rise in white supremacy across the globe. Not all Democrats are willing to go there, but the president and his advisors have made clear that they think it's, quote, outrageous to link anything of the two. But the president's kind of thin response to the white nationalism involved in this attack is certain to bring up it's gonna bring this back into the news cycle. He's being forced to respond to it again, and he's actually choosing to go on completely random tangents on Twitter. He's really been trying to move the headlines away from this incident, and I think we're going to see Democrats continue to try and bring this back.
And one other point that President Trump has gotten to again and again in the last few days is attacking the late Republican Senator John McCain. Said he's not a fan, never will be, at a press conference. The president was speaking in Lima, Ohio, at a tank plant and spent a few minutes criticizing the late senator. That's gotten some reaction from his own party, right?
That's right. Senator Johnny Isaacson of Georgia, he called President Trump's criticism deplorable. Specifically at McCain, at the criticism of McCain. Also, Martha McSally of Arizona just put something out on Twitter, not directly mentioning the president, but reaffirming that she thinks Senator McCain's legacy should be upheld by senior members of the administration, saying that he should be celebrated. But again, she doesn't specifically mention the president there. It's just another way he's changing the headlines on this. He's trying to get the nation to think about something else, especially he wants CNN and Fox News to start talking about something else. It's another sign that he's nervous about the growing investigations that are coming his way. There's all this chatter up here in D.C. this week about the coming Mueller report, all these investigations. So this is a common strategy we've seen him deploy, is to bring back a controversy that really sucks up Twitter, sucks up headlines, and gets the talking heads moving to something else that he said instead of what the investigations are really laying into him.
Talking to Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico, looking at some of the top news from the nation's capital. We'll turn now to election 2020 and the presidential race, and we'll let Dave start us off from Appleton. Dave, hi. What'd you want to bring up?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that Bill Weld is announced he's going to primary Trump on the Republican ticket already in 2020. I'm not sure how much credit he deserves. He was running as a Libertarian on the Libertarian ticket last year, but also endorsed Hillary at the same time. So he's a little bit all over the place. But he is a former Republican governor, and he's going to primary him.
Dave, thanks for the call. That, and there's talk of, I think it was Governor Larry Hogan from Maryland, I want to say, talking about a primary challenge. People talk about John Kasich. We'll spend some time on the Democrats, Sarah, but what is the talk of the town on a possible Republican primary challenge to the president?
I think everyone is still waiting to see what Governor Hogan of Maryland does and what he says. Of course, they're trying to stoke some speculation here. They want to keep their options open. We've even seen Jeb Bush weigh in on this. He's been supportive of Governor Hogan's potential interest. I think it's too early to tell, and I think a big factor is whether former Vice President Joe Biden weighs in. I think they believe they might share some of the same constituency and the same votes. So I think it's a wait-and-see game, as it will be for the next several months.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Nate with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you. I've got two issues I'm thinking about as I look forward to the next presidential election. The first one in the Democratic primary is if I think somebody could beat Trump, because I do think there are a number of things Trump is doing that just concern me for the country in the long term. Second issue is global warming, in that we actually had a program talking about the damages it was doing to places in the Midwest through flooding and stuff like that. And I want somebody who will not only take that serious, take that issue on, but I think it's very hypocritical that the people who claim, who lie and claim that environmentalists are socialists or something like that, These are fossil fuel companies profiting and then dumping the costs on other people.
Nate, thanks for the call on the 2020 presidential race and the latest, Sarah, Joe Biden may be about to run. He almost accidentally said he was running at one point. Beto O'Rourke officially in the race. Kirsten Gillibrand officially in the race now. To Nate's point, first of all, are candidates on the Democratic side talking about climate change?
I think it's something that will certainly ramp up as Democrats have a chance to get more into the issues. I think right now they're working on making their starting arguments. They're working to introduce themselves to the public. So we're going to hear a lot more about their personal stories. For example, when Senator Elizabeth Warren announced, she's, of course, featuring her dog very prominently in the video. They all want to bring their spouses in. They want to just have an introduction and let people know what they're about and who they are before they really deep dive into the issue. So I think that will be a couple months away. It will certainly be a big topic at the debates.
So Beto O'Rourke, former U.S. representative, a losing candidate in a Texas Senate race, but though he outperformed what Democrats usually do, there seem to be two kinds of articles, like just a lot of attention, a lot of profiles about him, and then a lot of media attention saying, why is he getting so much focus? So the, kind of the positive and negative there at the same time.
That's right. There's a really interesting story written by one of my colleagues about this Beto backlash, and that's the idea that he is a straight white male running in for the Democratic primary now, and he's in a field of almost entirely women or people of color, LGBT candidates, and he's the one who's dominating the headlines, and he's the one who's received cable news coverage wall to wall as soon as he began his tours. He's of course kicked off his announcement tour in Iowa, and he's spending a lot of time there getting a lot of attention. And I think there is a point to be made from these female candidates who haven't seen the same kind of coverage. You know, he got the Vanity Fair treatment, the Oprah Winfrey treatment, and it's something that female candidates are starting to question and say, hey, what about us?
Let's bring on another caller now. Judy is with us in Kenosha. Judy, hello.
Hi. My first and foremost concern is always health care as a nurse. That's what I vote about. But at this point, what I would vote about would be someone who doesn't trash talk the other opponent. So they're on the debate stage or whatever. If they would say, gosh, you know, my opponent is going to do what he thinks is right, but here's what I think is right, and just totally avoid the negativity and just only talk about what kinds of things they were going to do, boy, that would turn me on the candidate. Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter. If they're going to be complimentary and talk nicely to each other and talk about the good things they're going to do rather than the bad things their opponent is about. So that's my comment.
Judy, thanks for the call. And that's been a Democratic strategic issue. Do they need to directly attack President Trump and say bad things about him? Or do they assume that people already have their opinion of President Trump? They know who he is and how he is, and they should be focusing on their issues instead. What do you think, Sarah?
Well, it's interesting to watch some of the Democratic candidates. For instance, Kamala Harris, a former prosecutor from California, she is not afraid to rail into Trump and talk about his policies. She really wants to reiterate what she sees as the damage he's done to the country over the last several years. And then you compare her with someone like Senator Cory Booker, who's intentionally tried to avoid simply condemning President Trump and tried to make it more about bringing civility back to government. He talks a lot of these lofty ideals of not trash-talking opponents or really any part of politics. He just wants to bring back civility, and it's something that there are a lot of skeptics of. Is that something that can win? Is that something that can bring him the kind of media coverage that a presidential candidate will need to beat President Trump? Not every Democrat is convinced that that's the case, but Senator Booker is certainly standing out in the field for his approach on that.
And briefly, Sarah, you took a look at House Democratic priorities for their first 100 days, wrapping up their first 100 days in the new term. In our last minute, what are they focusing on?
Right. So in the next couple of weeks, they're going to be bringing up bills to address the gender pay gap. They're going to be working on expanding the decades-old Violence Against Women Act. That's actually been a surprisingly contentious issue with some protections that they're trying to add for transgender people that Republicans have been fighting against. So those will be mostly party line votes. There will also be notably a bipartisan vote to condemn U.S. involvement in Yemen. This is actually a do-over of an earlier House vote, which I was alluding to earlier with some of the Republican procedural gambits that has forced the House to vote on that again. And then they'll also be voting on net neutrality, which was another wonky issue that's come up again as House Democrats want to put their stamp on this issue. They want to halt the White House's net neutrality rules, and that's something that there are not right now many Republican co-sponsors, but it is an issue that there are. There is some Republican interest, so there's a chance that we could see some movement on there. But they're plowing ahead, and this will cap off their first 100 days in the majority. They've been passing a lot of big party line bills, and the question after that is, when will they start working on some of these bills that they've wanted to achieve results with Republicans?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter at Politico. She joined us to look at some of the week's top news in national politics, presidential race, congressional action, and more. You might have heard lately on the air some announcements, or if you get our newsletter, you've heard something about it. We're in the midst of a little renovation project here at Wisconsin Public Radio, redoing our studios. And that means as of, what was it, last Thursday? We moved over here last Thursday. We are not in what we call AM Combo. We are in Scenic Buck Studio. We lose our windows, but we're in a much bigger room. We got to get some pictures online to show people. I don't know who I go to do that, but we'll get some pictures out there at some point to show the work in progress. Our old studio is torn apart. We are in this temporary studio. It is kind of jury-rigged together. Like, for example, I'm sitting at what I think is my old desk from my office. I moved offices a while back, and the desk went away, and now it's the basis for my screens and my books and things like that as I do the show. And you may hear, as we said on the announcement, from time to time, little beeps and glitches and things like that. For the most part, I think we got a lot of the bugs ironed out. I don't want to jinx anything here. But do bear with us. Pardon our dust as we move along here. It's fun. We're having fun, right, Michelle? Yeah, we're getting used to it pretty quick. But bear with us, and we'll try to get some pictures. Actually, it's kind of a nice setup here. And we've got this like screen. I can actually look at our producers and make funny gestures at them on our little thing here. I'm doing it right now. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.